This is the Financial Sense News Hour. With the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income. Coming up on the program today, we're going to be talking about planning your portfolio during retirement. There are so many different aspects to this that are so much different than, let's say, when you were saving for retirement during your working career. So we're going to hit this topic today.
And I'm John Leffler, sitting in for Kathleen Harris today. Jim's going to interview Troy Onick on how to take advantage of academic and needs-based funding that is available out there in order to help get your kids through college, which is indeed part of your lifetime income planning.
And as everybody, I'm sure, is well aware, planning for college today and the cost of college has gotten to be expensive. I think, John, you probably have seen this figure. What is it? College education costs have been going up about 8% a year. They're starting to come down now with online education courses and degrees. But still, when you think about, you know, 3 decades of 8% inflation in college cost, it can cost a small fortune.
Well, that's true, having put 3 kids through college so far. And in trying to fund it, when you start into it, it can be quite bewildering, or you're wondering, how am I going to do this? Especially since the costs have been skyrocketing upwards, it doesn't seem any amount of savings will work. But if you do the right things in terms of scholarships, fellowships, and other grants that are available out there, you can actually fund a lot of the education.
And, you know, you can too, because people keep thinking, well, you have to have financial needs. It's also, if you have an Einstein in your family, there's also merit needs as well. And we're going to be talking about that with Troy Onick later on in the program. I want to begin and talk about portfolio planning during retirement, because one of the things that are so much different in retirement is really your portfolio is a working portfolio. It's doing something for you. It's either meeting your income needs, inflation needs, supplementing the extra things you want to do, travel and things like that. And that's why it's very important, because the 3 main objectives that you have in retirement are threefold. You want safety. You can't go back and make up if you lose a lot of your principal. You're going to need income. And you also have to think about inflation. How are you going to take care of future expenses? So I think investments need to be different, and they need to be more purposeful.
Yeah, this sounds a lot like advice I used to give to new parents. And I say, you're going to get a lot of advice from people. I have only one piece of advice. Ignore all the advice. And the same seems to be the same about standard type of portfolios. There's a lot of advice out there. It seems like a lot of these are following cookie cutter type of formulas, which may or may not be appropriate for what you're trying to do. Bond percentages seem to reflect what age you are, because remember, they've been changing, and there's a lot that doesn't account for a current environment. In the last decade, we've been through 2 bear markets, a housing bust. Now we're at 0% interest rates, which Janet Yellen seems very, very fond of, and something that we haven't seen in most of the lifetimes of the baby boomers or even some of the Gen Xers that follow them. This is a totally different environment. It's even different from when my father was trying to prepare for the eventuality that he might pass away early. How do you navigate this kind of an environment?
We spend so much of a part of this program talking about planning. And I use the analogy of building a home. You would never try to build a home. You know, you work with, let's say, an architect, you design a plan, there's structural elements, engineering elements that go into it right now. And it's the same thing with putting together a retirement plan and also a retirement portfolio. I mean, you need to have a plan, and probably more so today, John, than I think in the past. And that plan, it lets you know, first of all, what your income needs are. Because now that you're retired, you're not working, you may have greater needs for income. And more importantly, you need to know what those expenses are. What are your necessary day-to-day living expenses? What is that number? What are those discretionary expenses? Maybe joining a country club, playing golf, you know, travel expenses. All these things add up. And what happens when you have a plan, then what you do is your portfolio takes on greater purpose. It can help tailor your portfolio to meet those specific objectives, whether it's essential income needs or maybe future inflation needs or travel. So every part of your portfolio has a specific purpose. There's a design element to it, and it fulfills a particular need. And what this also does, John, I think is so important today, is it allows you to ignore the daily noise of the markets. But more importantly, it's going to give you something that most people desire when they're retired, is a greater sense of retirement security.
Yeah, security or lack of it seems to be what's generating the angst right now. You know, we see financial channels advertising that we should be planning, but, you know, there's some statistics out there, if you look, that show that greater than 70% of Americans have no plan. And a lot of times they either look at it and say, well, I can't do that. They throw up their hands and say, so much for that. Just have to mudge through it when it comes. And there's a common characteristic of human nature, and that is to procrastinate. But if you look around at where we are, you're chasing inflation upwards. Now, it isn't great, but you're still chasing it. If it ever comes to a hyperinflation, that's going to be really disastrous. The government policies that we have are hurting savers. You put Obamacare healthcare on top of that. Healthcare is becoming more expensive, and we haven't seen the end of that one. Americans are winding up paying more for their healthcare costs. And over the decades, we have really lost secure pensions, things that were really regular. I remember the time back in the 50s and 60s, say you work for a company like IBM. If you got a job there, you had that job for life. You know, you would work there for 30 or 40 years. You'd be building this big pension, and then they'd say goodbye and give you a crummy watch, you know. But at least you had your pension. Well, now you don't even have that in many cases. And it seems that we're actually losing secure health care as well. And that's the real big part of angst in retirement, because the higher your age, the higher the probability you're going to need health care services.
Yeah, you know, two good reasons, I think, today more so than ever before to have a plan is, you know, at one time you just talked about, John, most corporations, if you worked in the private sector, they had defined benefit pension plans. You pretty much knew if you worked for the company 20, 30 years, what you were going to have in terms of retirement check. We had Medicare, which you pretty much knew what your medical expenses. Now with Obamacare, everything is up in the air. You can't rely on pensions in the way you used to. And now a new element of uncertainty is being introduced to retirement, which is the uncertainty of healthcare.
Okay, so here we're trying to put some kind of a portfolio together, one that isn't a cookie cutter approach, but one that takes into account the reality of where we are, because ultimately reality always becomes real no matter what we might think. Now, you and Kathleen in shows past have discussed about the essentials of planning. There are budget essentials versus the non-essentials, or the gotta-haves versus the wanna-haves. Designing a portfolio that will fit at least the essentials, the needs that you have in there. But knowing that things are not going to be the way they were before and will be changing, the portfolio has to be flexible to meet changes in the market. And also, if your needs change, you can't anticipate everything in the world. You know, we've talked quite a lot, Jim, on the weekend programs about the role of dividends, that you should be into buying quality versus speculating. So perhaps we should get specific on putting portfolios together, how you make it fit the needs, how do you maintain it feasibly, and follow that moving target as you move towards retirement.
Well, I think as we talk so many times, and we've probably beat this drum so many times, people are tired of hearing about it. But John, it's essential. You need to start out with a plan, because you need to know what your needs are. What is it going to cost you on a day-to-day basis, on a monthly basis to live? And once you know what that number is, then it's much easier to design a portfolio to fit those specific needs. I mean, a portfolio really needs to be based on your circumstances, your needs. That's why I'm not a really big proponent today of these cookie cutter formulas that say, oh, you're age 65, you have X amount of dollars in this, X amount of dollars in that. It's like a standard commoditized approach to retirement planning. And as many people have found out, it oftentimes doesn't work. I mean, just look at the investment environment that we're in right now compared to where we were, let's say, 10, 15 years ago.
Well, what are the attributes that make up a portfolio? Obviously, it isn't just some kind of catch-all dump bucket. It has to be designed to achieve various goals. How is it different, say, for example, in retirement versus your working years?
When you take a look at designing a portfolio, first of all, it has to be realistic. I mean, if you haven't saved enough assets, you can't realistically come in and say, okay, I want a plan and I need 10, 12, 15% returns a year, kind of like what we saw in, let's say, the 90s, from 1995 to 2000. It seems like making 15% a year was just normal. And the other thing is, it not only needs to meet your needs, but also your temperament. I mean, some people, I don't care, are just not real comfortable with having a lot of money in the stock market, even blue chip stocks. But more importantly, John, because you're talking about you can spend anywhere from 20, 25 years in retirement between both spouses, it needs to have a long-term perspective. But more importantly, it needs to be clearly defined. And then that portfolio needs to be put together so your income needs are met, future inflation needs are met, you protect your assets against the loss of inflation over time, because that's one of the biggest things I see a lot of people experience as they retire. In the first couple of years, it's really nice, but over time, it starts to erode your standard of living. So all of those elements have to go into a design of a portfolio. And it may change over time as your needs change. Maybe there are healthcare issues and other things that come up. You need to help kids. One of you gets very, very sick, maybe, let's say, Alzheimer's, and you have to maintain two incomes. So all of those things are retirement issues that have to be put together in a portfolio, monitored, and make sure that those needs are met.
Well, a lot of this reminds me of learning how to fly. First, there's the theory about what you should be doing. And then there's the moment in the cockpit when you actually have to go through the steps of making it work. So there's the concept that we've just discussed. How do you go step by step through making it happen?
Number one, you determine what asset classes need to be represented in the portfolio. For some people, instead of bonds, you might have to do an immediate annuity because there is just not enough assets there to provide the income that you're going to need throughout your retirement. I like immediate annuities because you can't outspend them. In other words, the longer you live, you're still going to get the income. And then once you do that, you determine the percentage that each asset class should represent in the portfolio. In other words, how much are you going to need in an annuity or fixed bonds? How much are you going to need, let's say, in individual stocks? What kind of stocks? What kind of sectors? And then what happens is you select the securities, you put the portfolio in place. But more importantly, John, over time, you review the performance and the investment climate. I mean, just take a look at the investment climate over the last decade, how much it's changed. Did anybody 10, 13 years ago think that we'd be looking at 0% interest rates? When you get it all down, what you're really trying to do here is you're going to design a portfolio that has twofold need. First of all, you need to meet your income objectives. Secondly, and I guess you could call it growth, but you're going to need future growth needs, whether it's growth in income or growth in principal, because at some point you may need to tap into that principal for healthcare expenses. One of you ends up going into retirement home, and also your income needs in the future, because with inflation, I don't care whether you want to say it's going to be 2%, 3%, or 4%. All I can tell you is what you're spending on your basic living expenses today is going to be much higher 5 and 10 years from now.
How does this actually work in reality? I mean, first of all, you have to have assets to allocate, but then working through the process.
I think a lot of it, John, really depends on market conditions. Usually when you put together a plan, it takes 3 to 6 months to implement the portfolio, whether you're looking at laddered bonds and immediate annuity, and also putting together stocks. I mean, once you have the plan, you just don't say, okay, here's the money, you go into the market. It may not be a good time to go in the market, depending on, you know, what market conditions are. We may be going through a correction, or we may be going through a melt-up. Interest rates may be rising. It's a time process, and it should be done carefully because, you know, it's just like building a house. You're really putting together something that is going to meet your not only income needs, your security needs. And that's something that takes time to put together. It's not like you press a button, you put everything to work at once, and presto, you've got your retirement plan. Like anything else, it's going to take time to put into place. And more importantly, you're going to have to monitor it over time because interest rate conditions change, the economy changes, market conditions change, and heck, your own personal income needs may change. There may be things that come up. You're helping out kids, you're moving to another state, or you take up a hobby, or you have an illness. All of this needs to be monitored, and I think that's something that is all part of the process. You know, people think, okay, you put the plan in place, that's it. No, even if you have a home, you always know you're doing repairs and maintenance to your home. It's the same thing that you're doing with the portfolio.
Okay, to sum the whole thing up, you need to have a plan. That's the first step. It has to match your retirement requirements, the goals you're going to try to achieve. It needs to take into account the environment in which we're operating, which is constantly changing. And so all the way through putting the plan in place and keeping it there and even into retirement, you're going to have to monitor what is going on and make any changes that are truly, truly appropriate.
Well, that concludes this week's Lifetime Edition. Coming up next, I'm going to be speaking with Troy Unick. And of course, we're in the month of April. And of course, next month and the month after is graduation time. If you're a parent, grandparent, you probably have kids graduating from high school. You're thinking about college. And of course, you know, that's a major, major expense. And so many times we see mistakes made where parents, you cannot believe, folks, the amount of money that's available out there from colleges to grants. And it's not just based on an income need, it's also based on a merit need. So we're going to be talking about that next with my guest, Troy Unick, right after this. Well, you probably just got done filing your tax return, and if you're a parent, there's something else coming up. Graduation time. It begins in May, in June, and a lot of parents and a lot of you listening are thinking about how are you going to pay for that college aid? Joining me on the program is Troy Unick. He's chairman and CEO of Strategy. Troy, I want to begin with something that you talk about. 75% of families that come to you for college planning have 800 grand or more in investable assets. Most of those are in retirement accounts. Let's talk about that and the implications for getting financial aid.
The way the financial aid formulas work, when the colleges are determining a student's eligibility for need-based financial aid, they look at not only the parent and the student's income, but they also look at certain types of assets that they have, and they will exclude some assets from the aid calculation, and those assets are primarily retirement accounts, life insurance, cash values, in some cases even your home equity, and you know, just your personal belongings. Those things don't really count on the aid formula, but the areas that they do look at are mutual funds that you might just own in a brokerage account, or individual stocks and bonds, 529 college savings plans, education savings accounts that are known as covered health education savings accounts. All of those things do count against you, your checking, your savings, and so forth. And so when some families are applying for financial aid, depending on the income level of the parents, primarily, that may dictate whether the student would qualify for need-based financial aid or not, just based on that income. But then if they do qualify, then that's when we start really looking at whether or not these assets that they have that are also being counted going to dramatically affect that aid eligibility. So having more money in retirement accounts early on bodes well for increased financial aid eligibility down the road. But at the same time, you do need to have assets that are readily available in these other types of accounts that they're going to measure for financial aid eligibility. You have to have those liquid types of accounts in order to help fund your share of the cost. So you have to have a balance between retirement and your non-qualified savings and investments.
You know, something that when we think of financial aid, it's based on several factors. But first of all, Troy, why don't you clarify the type of aid? There are two kinds. There's academic or merit aid and a needs-based aid. You know, the academic merit is pretty straightforward. Obviously, if you have the grade, you get the aid. But let's distinguish the difference between the two and how that might change, let's say, when it comes to how you apply for college aid and the kind of assets that are counted.
Well, as you said, academic merit aid is the type of aid that if you have the grade, you get the aid. It's real straightforward. And primarily, colleges are going to look at the student's ACT or SAT score in combination with that student's particular GPA or grade point average. And it's important to point out that a college may look at a student's GPA and they may adjust that because they are going to take into consideration the rigor of the course that that student has availed themselves to at the particular school that they're enrolled at for high school. And so they may look at that academic profile of that student and say, okay, we're going to adjust because this student took a lot of AP courses and so forth. And they'll actually then come up with a profile that is going to correspond to the way they calculate things themselves. And then that will determine whether that student qualifies for academic merit aid or not at that particular college or university. And it's important to note that a lot of colleges don't even offer academic merit aid. So the most elite colleges that are out there, the most selective colleges, the Ivy League schools, the Stanford, Dukes, and the Wesleyans of the world, they do not offer academic merit aid. So you could have the greatest academic scores in the world and your child's not going to get a dime in financial aid at most of those highly selective colleges. Most public colleges don't offer a lot of academic merit aid either. There is a group of private colleges that kind of fall between the elite private and flagship state universities that do offer a substantial amount of academic merit aid. And so if you're not going to qualify for the other type of aid, need-based financial aid, which is based on your family's finances, then the family really needs to be looking at these particular schools that do offer this academic merit aid. Now, a need-based financial aid, essentially they're taking the cost of attendance of the school and they're subtracting out your expected family contribution. That is called your EFC. And that number is going to be calculated based on the information that the family submits on the financial aid form. Now, there's two forms. There's a free application for federal student aid, which all the colleges have to use in order to determine a student's eligibility for federal and, in most cases, state aid. And a lot of the public universities also use that same form to determine the student's eligibility for their own institutional dollars. There is a second form called the CSS profile that's administrated by the college board, and it is going to ask for a lot more financial information. They will look at things like home equity, and they may, to some degree, look at other types of assets above and beyond what the FAFSA does. And the reason for that form is that at the more elite colleges, most of which are private, they are going to be using that form and that institutional methodology of calculating the student's expected family contribution, which will then in turn help the college dictate whether or not the student qualifies for any of their own institutional financial aid money. So you've got two distinct types of financial aid. You've got merit aid and you've got need-based aid. And in fact, merit aid is most often awarded by the admissions department, not the financial aid department, because they're the ones that are bringing in the information on the student's academics, their GPA, their test scores. And so a student might actually get a financial aid award, an academic merit aid award, before they've even submitted their financial aid form. So it's important to know which colleges offer which type of aid and which formulas they're actually going to use to assess your child's need for financial aid at their institution.
Troy, I want to talk about something that often can create problems in applying for college aid. A lot of times grandparents want to do something for their grandchildren, or sometimes even parents. And what they start doing is they contribute to a child's account and build up sometimes what could be substantial assets, depending on the size of the gifts, in the child's name. Now, it creates two problems. If the assets get large enough and produce enough income, you could have a tax throwback to the parents. But also, in many ways, since those assets are accounted for college aid, the student's assets, number one, it may prevent them from getting the type of aid that they want, or let's say the parents are hoping to get. And number two, when you put those assets in the child's name at age 18, they become theirs. And if they want to use those assets to go out and buy a brand new Porsche or something, there's nothing the parents can do. Let's talk about some of the issues that come up with that.
You've opened up a great topic here because there are so many ramifications of doing what you mentioned, where the grandparents, you know, really trying to do the right thing and help out their grandchildren and their adult children paying for this high cost of college these days. And so it's a case of good intentions, but many times, you know, unforeseen consequences. Because as you mentioned, you know, when you put the money into the child's name, let's say it's in a brokerage account or even a savings or checking, whatever it is, or it might be a direct gift of stock shares, that money is now irrevocably given to the child. So that is now the child's asset, even if they're under the age of 18, they may be in a custodial account. And then as you alluded to, when you get to that point where the child now reaches age 18, some states age 21, that asset is theirs. and it's a whole Harvard versus buying the Harley thing. You don't have any control over that. The child may want to go buy the Harley, and you want them to go to Harvard. So that's why with the advent of 529 college savings plans going back 15, 16 years ago, they have created a vehicle by having those types of accounts, that 529 college savings plan account, in which the grandparents can make this type of a gift, but really still exercise control over that. So they put the money into the 529 account. They're the owner, and they name the grandchild as the beneficiary, and therefore they have control over the account. If they want to change the beneficiary, you know, then they can do that. If the child says, you know, grandpa and grandma, thanks for putting the money in there, but I really do want the Harley, I don't want to go to Harvard, then, you know, you can just make it so they don't have access to that. But if you've given the money to them in a direct gift and it's sitting in the child's brokerage account, they turn 18, all of a sudden they can do with it as they please. And the other big ramification of doing this type of gifting is that, as you said, it does count as an asset in the student's name. And therefore, under most of the formulas, it's going to count more heavily against the student for financial aid than if, for example, that money were in the parent's name. So on the financial aid form, on the FAFSA and then the CSS profile, if the money is in a reportable account, that type of account, let's say the brokerage account that is owned by the parent, then it's going to be assessed at somewhere between 5 and 5.64%, depending on the formula. If that same brokerage account were in the student's name, the student is the owner, maybe the parent is the custodian, now all of a sudden it's going to be assessed at 20 to 25%. So it gets a much greater weighting in the aid formula, so it counts a lot more against the student for aid eligibility. So there are some downsides to doing that, but then, like everything in college planning, the answer to most questions is it depends. And if you're in one of the situations where maybe you're not going to qualify for need-based aid at a particular college because of your finances, maybe your income alone is too high, so it doesn't matter where your assets are, then we kind of want to take more of an offensive approach to paying for college. We're not going to be so concerned about need-based financial aid, but we might want to look at colleges that offer the academic merit aid money that can help bring down that cost of attending. And at the same time, we want to always find the best way to fund that share of the cost that you have to come up with. And so maybe we should be focusing on the gifting to the child, shifting even earned income as well as unearned income to the child, and taking advantage of what we can on their own tax return. So in some cases, it's actually more strategic for mass affluent families, as they're sometimes called, to be focusing on tax savings and going kind of on the offensive and trying to help reduce the overall cost of college by shifting assets and income into the child's name, which is just the opposite of what you would do if you're trying to qualify for more need-based financial aid. So you have kind of a pivot point there, and it's just important for families to kind of look ahead. You said graduation is coming up in June, and some families are going to be visiting colleges. So be able to look ahead, identify which colleges might offer some academic merit aid money, which ones will not, how they are going to count the assets that you have against you for financial aid purposes under the respective aid forms and formulas, so that you can look down this road ahead of you beyond this graduation point and kind of get an idea. Know before you go, know before you visit the college, and know before you even go to apply which ones you really could afford.
You know, this brings up a real interesting economic issue that has long-term implications, not only for college, but let's say a student's future career and also their lifestyle. Because I forget where I saw the statistic, Troy, you probably have this figure at your fingertips, but the average college student leaves college with about $30,000 of debt. That assumes, number one, they didn't go to college out of state. Number two, they didn't go to a private college. Now, if you take, let's say, a husband and wife that eventually get married out of college, both bringing in $60,000 to $100,000 of debt, that really has an impact on their family life. I mean, it's very hard to get qualified to buy a new home when you start out with maybe $60,000, $80,000, $100,000 of debt. Think also of, let's say, car payments. And it's one of the reasons that economists have said we've seen fewer household formations because of the size and the amount of debt that students are taking on to get through college. So let's talk about the implications of really doing some proper planning here, because you really, by doing the good planning, it takes the burden off from, let's say, the student and the parents. So one mistake is the student will not have to enter life or their working career with a huge amount of debt they have to pay down. And secondly, another mistake I see is where parents are getting closer to retirement and they just draw down a lot of their assets, leaving a good portion that is used up for college and not available for their own retirement.
That's exactly right. And, you know, when we talk to families, one of the questions about college planning is specifically we ask them, how old will you be, mom and dad, when your youngest child graduates from college? And that is usually one of the first points in our discussion where reality starts to set in. And the part of this equation that they don't focus on more clearly than they should is that they look at college, they look at their children, they want to do the best thing for them, they've raised these children, they have all these things that they've done along the way, you know, the late night crying sessions and, you know, the first day of school and all these other steps along the way, they've done all the things, the soccer camp and all these things that they've done for these children, and they want to make sure they get college right. And so they will many times make the mistake, and it's emotionally driven, where they will say, look, we'll do whatever. If they get into this particular college, we'll be happy to do whatever to make that happen. So they will forsake their own security, which is probably something that they need to be dealing with sooner than they realize, which is their retirement. That time frame is not that far away from when they have to really start thinking about retiring, and yet they're willing to spend almost blindly on their children. So it's something that I've tried to put into a phrase that locks in with parents over the years, and that is that college is a toll booth on the road to retirement. And so we need to find ways to help the parents reduce the cost of those tolls, know which exits that they may be able to afford ahead of time, and kind of give them the advice that acts as an easy path so that they can cruise through that easy path lane and stay at the speed for retirement. And when we can do that, then we really are helping the parents and the students. And as you said, you know, most students are coming out with $30,000 in debt. If we talk about a household forming a couple, a family, you know, you've got $60,000 to $100,000, that is a major anchor. And it will delay financial buying decisions, you know, the home and the car and all those different things. It makes it more challenging. The other thing it does that I like to point out is that, you know, when you start out as a student, you get that initial job, you're not starting midway up the pay scale. You're starting at the bottom. And so maybe the job that you need is in a metropolitan area. And so when you get there, you've got to have the apartment and all these other things to get you in place. Well, if you have so much in student loan debt, $400 to $800 a month in student loan debt, you may not be able to afford to move there to take that job. There's no way you can make it happen by the time you pay the apartment and the utilities. Even if you're still living on crackers and macaroni and cheese and peanut butter, you're not going to be able to pay the student loan payment on top of that. So it's even affecting them before they get out of college, really, and into that first job as to where they can actually move to take that job. So it's really important to pick colleges wisely and try to understand ahead of time which ones you can afford without taking on that kind of debt. And that applies to both the parent and the student, because what the parents spend on college, they're not going to have for retirement, and they're not going to have to grow fund that money between now and retirement. So there are many negative ripple effects that are going to apply throughout the student's life as well as the parent.
Let's talk about the importance of planning, because a lot of times it seems like those high school years go so fast. Next thing you know, you're scrambling, you're trying to find a good college, and you have a short time to really go through the aid package, and not only that, just the acceptance package itself. Let's talk about, Troy, some of the things that go on these forms that you submit for college aid or, let's say, merit.
Well, when you complete your application for admission to an institution, you're sending along your transcript and so forth, and so that admissions department will then pull that information off of there and make a determination on if, in fact, they even offer academic merit aid, if that student is going to be awarded any money. So that's the first step. And we can kind of anticipate some of that by looking on each college's website. And then also, you can go ahead and use the net price calculators that are on each college's website by law these days to kind of get an estimate of where you would stand from a need-based financial aid perspective. And the net price calculators will also, in many cases, factor in any academic merit aid that the student might be eligible for. You can do this even before you would apply. And then that gives you an idea up front that, okay, this is kind of what the net cost might be to us. And we now have to look at our own personal resources, our income, our assets, and figure out, can we afford out of our discretionary cash flow every month out of our budget to allocate some of that to help pay for college? And maybe we have X amount of resources over here in terms of different types of assets, different types of accounts, 529 plans, brokerage accounts, savings, checking, whatever. What can we pull from that we can allocate over the next 4 years to help fund this cost? And are we in the ballpark after an estimated amount of financial aid? And then you need to go through the process, actually apply for admission. If you get accepted, and then they're going to send you that financial aid award, which has just happened over the last few weeks for this group of students, the high school seniors. So they now know where they've been admitted, and they've been given a financial aid award. Now it's the colleges who are waiting to hear back from the students as to who will actually commit and then make that deposit and then ultimately enroll. That's kind of what the process is going to be like for parents that are looking at these toll booths out in front of them. That's what they will go through. That's a simplistic explanation of the process. Now, when we are going to be trying to be proactive in this manner and identify which colleges we can afford, again, it's important just to remember that the aid estimates might come back from a net price calculator and tell you that you might be eligible for $15,000 in aid, or maybe it's zero. But part of the process is actually going through submitting the financial aid forms and then getting that financial aid award back from the college, the actual award, not an estimate. And what did they actually offer? This is what the reality is. Forget the estimates, forget the net price calculator. What did they offer? And how much of this financial aid award amount is just student loans, how much of it is work study, and how much is actually grant money that we don't have to repay. And really being able to understand that will dictate more about whether you can really afford that college or not, and how much debt you might have to take on if you did choose to go to that particular school, so that you're making that from a more informed standpoint.
You know, Troy, what is the realistic time frame that is involved in applying for college aid? I know a lot of times getting your SAT scores, your application into various colleges, your application package can be quite time consuming. What about the aid process itself? Institutions sometimes are like anything else. They're sort of like bureaucratic. How long could that take?
Well, generally, the colleges will require that a financial aid form, whether it's just the FAFSA or the CSS profile, be submitted by a specific date. And those specific dates can actually be dictated by how you're applying for admission to a particular institution. So these days, when most of us parents and grandparents went to college, you just applied in the late fall and early spring, and that was it. There were no other options. It's just a regular decision. These days, we have things called early decision, early action, non-binding early action. You have all these different ways in which you can apply to a institution for admission. And so if you're applying early decision, for example, at an Ivy League school, then you may have to submit the CSS profile in November or December. But after January 1st is the earliest time that you can actually submit the FAFSA, the free application for federal student aid. So you may have two different deadlines. And, you know, they said one of them, the FAFSA, is pretty straightforward. The CSS profile is way more complicated and takes a lot more time and focus to actually get it submitted. And so you have two different timelines, two different forms. Now, again, not all colleges will require that CSS profile. So you might just be dealing with a March 15th deadline at a given institution for the FAFSA. So once you've submitted these financial aid forms, regardless of the deadlines, then pretty much instantaneously, once they're processed, you've submitted the data and they say, okay, this will be processed in the next 24 to 48 hours. And then it generates a report on the FAFSA. It's called a student aid report. And it will tell you then what your calculated expected family contribution is under that federal aid calculation of expected family contribution. And then that information, that EFC number and the other data that you've submitted, they're going to go out to all the colleges that you've listed on the financial aid form that you want to share this information with. And then at that point, that's when they take their cost of attendance, subtract out your share of the cost, that EFC number, and then that tells the financial aid officer whether you demonstrated a need for financial aid. So that, again, that's separate and distinct from the money that a student might get from the admission side of an institution where you've applied and they said, okay, we have academic merit aid money. congratulations, you're going to be awarded $10,000 per year under our Dean Scholarship. So then the financial aid office, now after you've submitted the financial aid form, they take the merit aid money and any need-based financial aid that the student's going to be awarded either from the federal government, from the state, from private sources, which you have to disclose to the school. So if you want a Kiwanis scholarship or something from your church or whatever, then you need to let the financial aid office know that you've been awarded those dollars. And then they take all of that into consideration and they actually package together all of that. That's what the financial aid office does. They package all that different types of aid together, and that's called your financial aid award. And then once you've been admitted to that particular institution, and they're sending you the admission notice and the financial aid award letter. And then if you feel for some reason that you need to appeal that, then there's a process, and it can be different at each institution, that you must follow according to their protocol in order to appeal that financial aid award. Maybe you have unusual circumstances, or maybe mom or dad just lost a job, or whatever the case might be, you have very high medical expenses, some unforeseen circumstance. And so now you're going through this process of appealing, and you're doing it not just because you're begging for money, but you're doing it because you have a legitimate reason and you're not wasting the financial aid office's time. And now they're going to come back to you, you know, either just say, look, there's really not anything we can do, or yeah, thank you for submitting this, we can reconsider. They have the authority as financial aid officers to invoke what's referred to as professional judgment, and they can go in and they can make changes to your aid package accordingly. And so that is kind of the way the process works in full. And then once you've accepted admission and you've accepted your financial aid award, and you make the commitment and you send in your deposit, and then you are going to be heading off to college in the fall.
Troy, finally, since there are a lot of various calculations, you talk about the FAFSA and the CSS profile. Are there software or things that you use, or let's say if somebody wanted to contact you, that could aid in putting that profile together for the best possibility of receiving either a merit aid or financial aid?
Yes, actually, we have created a software tool called Smart Search, and it will help the family determine ahead of time where the child may be able to get into college, get aid, and which colleges they can actually afford. And that tool does a fantastic job of laying out all of the steps and bring it into a, you know, pretty concise picture to simplify it all. And so it does kind of act as that easy path that I mentioned. So we can look down the road and it can help us identify ahead of time which exits we can afford, ways we might be able to reduce the cost of the toll and kind of cruise through that easy path lane and stay up to speed for retirement. So we license the software to financial advisors, educational consultants, and other institutions. But I also work directly with families and their financial advisors to help that particular family understand what their best strategy is to pay for college and preserve assets for retirement. Because as we discussed, you know, it's not going to be very long, and mom and dad really are going to be focusing on their next big financial adventure, which is going to be retirement. And they can't torpedo themselves during the college years and hope to do well in retirement. So we have to really be able to balance all of that together. And really, the families that have saved and done well, they are the ones that really look at what they have accumulated and they say, hey, you know, I want to do the best thing for my child. I want to give them the best education possible, but it took us 18 or 30 years to accumulate this. And, you know, now I'm going to watch, you know, when the cost of college is $65,000 per year at the elite schools, you know, that's over $250,000 per child. So I could watch half of my net worth walk out the door in the next 4 to 8 years. And so we got to find a way to get that, you know, the best colleges, the best price, so we can preserve assets for retirement and do the best things for themselves too. You have to have that kind of balance to be a good steward of the whole financial picture.
Well, Troy, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out more about the work that you do in helping parents or students apply for financial aid, how could they do so, please?
You can go right to our website, which is strategy.com, and that's spelled strategee.com. And they can also just Google my name, Troy Inint, O-N-I-N-T, and you'll find me all over the web with various articles I've written for the media and all of these things that we've discussed.
Troy, listen, thanks so much for joining us on the program. And remember, if you're a parent or a student listening to this broadcast, you know, it really makes a difference if you take some time and do some planning. It can make all the world of difference whether you get that aid, whether it's merit or financial need. and have that college paid for, at least assisted with, versus leaving college with a lot of debt. Troy, once again, thanks for joining us on the program.
Thank you, Jim.
That concludes our interview on college planning. And once again, as we have emphasized so often here on Lifetime Income, planning can really make the difference, whether you're planning for retirement or planning for your own education or your children's education or your grandchildren's education. Really take some time, put a plan together. It can make the difference financially for your loved ones. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for tuning in to this week's Lifetime Edition. Kathleen Harris will be back on the program next week. But until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.